Out of the Silent Planet by C.S. Lewis. Copyright 1938 by Clive Staples Lewis. This unabridged recording of Out of the Silent Planet was published by arrangement with the C.S. Lewis Company and was produced in 2000 by Blackstone Audiobooks Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audiobooks. This book is read by Jeffrey Howard. This book is 160 pages long. Out of the Silent Planet by C.S. Lewis. The following material appears on the book's back cover. C.S. Lewis is a master of fantasy. Saturday Review. A delicious book full of wisdom and savor. Christopher Morley. A Delightful Fantasy. New York Herald Tribune. C.S. Lewis, perhaps best known as the author of the Screwtape Letters, was professor of medieval and Renaissance literature at Cambridge University until his death in 1963. He also wrote the well-loved Chronicles of Narnia, a series of stories for children, as well as non-fiction, including The Problem of Pain and Miracles. To my brother, W.H.L., a lifelong critic of the space and time story. Note, certain slighting references to earlier stories of this type, which will be found in the following pages, have been put there for purely dramatic purposes. The author would be sorry if any reader supposed he was too stupid to have enjoyed Mr. H.G. Wells's fantasies, or too ungrateful to acknowledge his debt to them. C.S.L. Chapter 1. The last drops of the thunder shower had hardly ceased falling when the pedestrian stuffed his map into his pocket, settled his pack more comfortably on his tired shoulders, and stepped out from the shelter of a large chestnut tree into the middle of the road. A violent yellow sunset was pouring through a rift in the clouds to westward, but straight ahead over the hills the sky was the colour of dark slate. Every tree and blade of grass was dripping, and the road shone like a river. The pedestrian wasted no time on the landscape, but set out at once with the determined stride of a good walker who has lately realised that he will have to walk farther than he intended. That indeed was his situation. If he had chosen to look back, which he did not, he could have seen the spire of Much Naderby, and, seeing it, might have uttered a malediction on the inhospitable little hotel which, though obviously empty, had refused him a bed. The place had changed hands since he last went for a walking tour in these parts. The kindly old landlord on whom he had reckoned had been replaced by someone whom the barmaid referred to as the lady. And the lady was apparently a British innkeeper of that orthodox school who regard guests as a nuisance. His only chance now was Sturck, on the far side of the hills, and a good 6 miles away. The map marked an inn at Sturck. The pedestrian was too experienced to build any very sanguine hopes on this, but there seemed nothing else within range. He walked fairly fast and doggedly, without looking much about him, like a man trying to shorten the way with some interesting train of thought. He was tall, but a little round-shouldered, about 35 to 40 years of age, and dressed with that particular kind of shabbiness which marks a member of the intelligentsia on holiday. He might easily have been mistaken for a doctor or a schoolmaster at first sight, though he had not the man-of-the-world air of the one or the indefinable breeziness of the other. In fact, he was a philologist and a fellow of a Cambridge college. His name was Ransom. He had hoped, when he left Naderby, that he might find a night's lodging at some friendly farm before he had walked as far as Sturck. But the land this side of the hill seemed almost uninhabited. It was a desolate, featureless sort of country, mainly devoted to cabbage and turnip, with poor hedges and few trees. It attracted no visitors like the richer country south of Naderby, and it was protected by the hills from the industrial areas beyond Sturck. As the evening drew in and the noise of the birds came to an end, it grew more silent than an English landscape usually is. The noise of his own feet on the metalled road became irritating. He had walked thus for a matter of 2 miles when he became aware of a light ahead. He was close under the hills by now, and it was nearly dark, so that he still cherished hopes of a substantial farmhouse until he was quite close to the real origin of the light, which proved to be a very small cottage of ugly 19th-century brick. A woman darted out of the open doorway as he approached it and almost collided with him.
"I beg your pardon, sir," she said. "I thought it was my Harry."
Ransom asked her if there was any place nearer than Stirk where he might possibly get a bed.
"Oh, no, sir," said the woman. "Not nearer than Stirk. I dare say they might fix you up at Naderby."
She spoke in a humbly fretful voice, as if her mind were intent on something else. Ransom explained that he had already tried Naderby.
"Well, then I don't know, I'm sure, sir," she replied. "There isn't hardly any house before Stirk, not what you want. There's only the Rise, where my Harry works, and I thought you was coming from that way, sir, and that's why I come out when I heard you, thinking it might be him. He ought to be home this long time."
"The Rise," said Ransom. "What's that, a farm? Would they put me up?"
"Oh, no, sir. You see, there's no one there now except the professor and the gentleman from London, not since Miss Alice died. They wouldn't do anything like that, sir. They don't even keep any servants, except my Harry, for doing the furnace-like, and he's not in the house."
"What's this professor's name?" asked Ransom, with a faint hope.
"I don't know, I'm sure, sir," said the woman. "The other gentleman's Mr. Devine, he is, and Harry says the other gentleman is a professor. He don't know much about it, you see, sir, being a little simple, and that's why I don't like him coming home so late, and they said they'd always send him home at 6 o'clock. It isn't as if he didn't do a good day's work, either."
The monotonous voice and the limited range of the woman's vocabulary did not express much emotion, but Ransom was standing sufficiently near to perceive that she was trembling and nearly crying. It occurred to him that he ought to call on the mysterious professor and ask for the boy to be sent home. And it occurred to him just a fraction of a second later that once he were inside the house, among men of his own profession, he might very reasonably accept the offer of a night's hospitality. Whatever the process of thought may have been, he found that the mental picture of himself calling at the Rise had assumed all the solidity of a thing determined upon. He told the woman what he intended to do.
"Oh, thank you very much, sir, I'm sure," she said. "And if you would be so kind as to see him out of the gate and on the road before you leave, if you see what I mean, sir. He's that frightened of the professor, and he wouldn't come away once your back was turned, sir, not if they hadn't sent him home themselves, like."
Ransom reassured the woman as well as he could, and bade her good-bye, after ascertaining that he would find the Rise on his left in about 5 minutes. Stiffness had grown upon him while he was standing still, and he proceeded slowly and painfully on his way. There was no sign of any lights on the left of the road, nothing but the flat fields and a mass of darkness which he took to be a copse. It seemed more than 5 minutes before he reached it, and found that he had been mistaken. It was divided from the road by a good hedge, and in the hedge was a white gate. And the trees which rose above him as he examined the gate were not the first line of a copse, but only a belt, and the sky showed through them. He felt quite sure now that this must be the gate of the Rise, and that these trees surrounded a house and garden. He tried the gate and found it locked. He stood for a moment undecided, discouraged by the silence and the growing darkness. His first inclination, tired as he felt, was to continue his journey to Stirk, but he had committed himself to a troublesome duty on behalf of the old woman. He knew that it would be possible, if one really wanted, to force a way through the hedge. He did not want to. A nice fool he would look, blundering in upon some retired eccentric, the sort of a man who kept his gates locked in the country, with this silly story of a hysterical mother in tears because her idiot boy had been kept half an hour late at his work. Yet it was perfectly clear that he would have to get in, and since one cannot crawl through a hedge with a pack on, he slipped his pack off and flung it over the gate. The moment he had done so, it seemed to him that he had not, till now, fully made up his mind, now that he must break into the garden, if only in order to recover the pack. He became very angry with the woman, and with himself, but he got down on his hands and knees and began to worm his way into the hedge. The operation proved more difficult than he had expected, and it was several minutes before he stood up in the wet darkness on the inner side of the hedge, smarting from his contact with thorns and nettles. He groped his way to the gate, picked up his pack, and then for the first time turned to take stock of his surroundings. It was lighter on the drive than it had been under the trees, and he had no difficulty in making out a large stone house, divided from him by a width of untidy, neglected lawn. The drive branched into two a little way ahead of him, the right-hand path leading in a gentle sweep to the front door, while the left ran straight ahead, doubtless to the back premises of the house. He noticed that this path was churned up into deep ruts, now full of water, as if it were used to carrying a traffic of heavy lorries. The other, on which he now began to approach the house, was overgrown with moss. The house itself showed no light. Some of the windows were shuttered, some gaped blank without shutter or curtain, but all were lifeless and inhospitable. The only sign of occupation was a column of smoke that rose from behind the house, with a density which suggested the chimney of a factory, or at least of a laundry, rather than that of a kitchen. The rise was clearly the last place in the world where a stranger was likely to be asked to stay the night, and Ransom, who had already wasted some time in exploring it, would certainly have turned away, if he had not been bound by his unfortunate promise to the old woman. He mounted the three steps which led into the deep porch, rang the bell, and waited. After a time he rang the bell again, and sat down on a wooden bench which ran along one side of the porch. He sat so long that, though the night was warm and starlit, the sweat began to dry on his face, and a faint chilliness crept over his shoulders. He was very tired by now, and it was perhaps this which prevented him from rising and ringing a third time. This, and the soothing stillness of the garden, the beauty of the summer sky, and the occasional hooting of an owl somewhere in the neighbourhood, which seemed only to emphasise the underlying tranquillity of his surroundings. Something like drowsiness had already descended upon him when he found himself startled into vigilance. A peculiar noise was going on, a scuffing, irregular noise, vaguely reminiscent of a football scrum. He stood up. The noise was unmistakable by now. People in boots were fighting or wrestling or playing some game. They were shouting, too. He could not make out the words, but he heard the monosyllabic barking ejaculations of men who are angry and out of breath. The last thing Ransom wanted was an adventure, but a conviction that he ought to investigate the matter was already growing upon him when a much louder cry rang out, in which he could distinguish the words, "Let me go! Let me go!" Then a second later, "I'm not going in there! Let me go home!" Throwing off his pack, Ransom sprang down the steps of the porch and ran round to the back of the house as quickly as his stiff and footsore condition allowed him. The ruts and pools of the muddy path led him to what seemed to be a yard, but a yard surrounded with an unusual number of outhouses. He had a momentary vision of a tall chimney, a low door filled with red firelight, and a huge round shape that rose black against the stars, which he took for the dome of a small observatory. Then all this was blotted out of his mind by the figures of three men who were struggling together, so close to him that he almost cannoned into them. From the very first, Ransom felt no doubt that the central figure, whom the two others seemed to be detaining, in spite of his struggles, was the old woman's Harry. He would like to have thundered out, "What are you doing to that boy?" But the words that actually came, in a rather unimpressive voice, were, "Here, I say." The three combatants suddenly fell apart, the boy blubbering. "May I ask," said the thicker and taller of the two men, "who the devil you may be and what you are doing here?" His voice had all the qualities which Ransom's had so regrettably lacked. "I'm on a walking tour," said Ransom, "and I promised a poor woman—" "Poor woman be damned," said the other. "How did you get in?"
"Through the hedge," said Ransom, who felt a little ill-temper coming to his assistance. "I don't know what you're doing to that boy, but—"
"We ought to have a dog in this place," said the thick man to his companion, ignoring Ransom.
"You mean we should have a dog if you hadn't insisted on using Tartar for an experiment," said the man who had not yet spoken. He was nearly as tall as the other, but slender, and apparently the younger of the two, and his voice sounded vaguely familiar to Ransom. The latter made a fresh beginning. "Look here," he said, "I don't know what you are doing to that boy, but it's long after hours, and it's high time you sent him home. I haven't the least wish to interfere in your private affairs, but—"
"Who are you?" bawled the thick man.
"My name is Ransom, if that is what you mean, and—"
"By Jove!" said the slender man. "Not Ransom, who used to be at Weddenshaw?"
"I was at school at Weddenshaw," said Ransom.
"I thought I knew you as soon as you spoke," said the slender man. "I'm Divine. Don't you remember me?"
"Of course I should think I do," said Ransom, as the two men shook hands with the rather laboured cordiality which is traditional in such meetings. In actual fact, Ransom had disliked Divine at school as much as anyone he could remember.
"Touching, isn't it?" said Divine. "The far-flung line even in the wilds of Stirk and Naderby. This is where we get a lump in our throats and remember Sunday evening chapel in the D.O.P. You don't know Weston, perhaps?" Divine indicated his massive and loud-voiced companion. "The Weston," he added. "You know, the great physicist has Einstein on toast and drinks a pint of Schrödinger's blood for breakfast. Weston, allow me to introduce my old schoolfellow Ransom, Dr. Elwin Ransom, the Ransom, you know, the great philologist. Has Jespersen on toast and drinks a pint—" "I know nothing about it," said Weston, who was still holding the unfortunate Harry by the collar. "And if you expect me to say that I am pleased to see this person who has just broken into my garden, you will be disappointed. I don't care tuppence what school he was at, nor on what unscientific foolery he is at present wasting money that ought to go to research. I want to know what he's doing here, and after that I want to see the last of him."
"Oh, don't be an ass, Weston," said Divine, in a more serious voice. "His dropping in is delightfully apropos. Oh, you mustn't mind Weston's little way, Ransom. Conceals a generous heart beneath a grim exterior, you know. You'll come in and have a drink and something to eat, of course?" "Well, that's very kind of you," said Ransom. "But about the boy?" Divine drew Ransom aside. "Barmy," he said in a low voice. "Works like a beaver, as a rule, but gets these fits. We are only trying to get him into the wash-house and keep him quiet for an hour or so till he's normal again. Can't let him go home in his present state. All done by kindness. You can take him home yourself presently, if you like, and come back and sleep here." Ransom was very much perplexed. There was something about the whole scene suspicious enough and disagreeable enough to convince him that he had blundered on something criminal, while on the other hand he had all the deep, irrational conviction of his age and class that such things could never cross the path of an ordinary person except in fiction, and could least of all be associated with professors and old schoolfellows. Even if they had been ill-treating the boy, Ransom did not see much chance of getting him from them by force. While these thoughts were passing through his head, Divine had been speaking to Weston in a low voice, but no lower than was to be expected of a man discussing hospitable arrangements in the presence of a guest. It ended with a grunt of assent from Weston. Ransom, to whose other difficulties a merely social embarrassment was now being added, turned with the idea of making some remark. But Weston was now speaking to the boy. "You have given enough trouble for one night, Harry," he said, "and in a properly governed country I'd know how to deal with you. Hold your tongue and stop snivelling. You needn't go into the wash-house if you don't want."
"It weren't the wash-house," sobbed the half-wit. "You know it weren't. I don't want to go in that thing again."
"He means the laboratory," interrupted Divine. "He got in there and was shut in by accident for a few hours once. It put the wind up him for some reason. Low, the poor Indian, you know." He turned to the boy. "Listen, Harry," he said, "that kind gentleman is going to take you home as soon as he's had a rest. If you'll come in and sit down quietly in the hall, I'll give you something you like." He imitated the noise of a cork being drawn from a bottle. Ransom remembered it had been one of Divine's tricks at school, and a guffaw of infantile knowingness broke from Harry's lips. "Bring him in," said Weston as he turned away and disappeared into the house. Ransom hesitated to follow, but Divine assured him that Weston would be very glad to see him. The lie was barefaced, but Ransom's desire for a rest and a drink were rapidly overcoming his social scruples. Preceded by Divine and Harry, he entered the house and found himself a moment later seated in an armchair and awaiting the return of Divine, who had gone to fetch refreshments.
Chapter 2. The room into which he had been shown revealed a strange mixture of luxury and squalor. The windows were shuttered and curtainless, the floor was uncarpeted and strewn with packing-cases, shavings, newspapers and boots, and the wallpaper showed the stains left by the pictures and furniture of the previous occupants. On the other hand, the only two armchairs were of the costliest type, and in the litter which covered the tables, cigars, oyster shells, and empty champagne bottles, jostled with tins of condensed milk and open sardine tins with cheap crockery, broken bread and teacups a quarter full of tea and cigarette ends. His host seemed to be a long time away, and Ransom fell to thinking of Divine. He felt for him that sort of distaste we feel for someone whom we have admired in boyhood for a very brief period, and then outgrown. Divine had learned, just half a term earlier than anyone else, that kind of humour which consists in a perpetual parody of the sentimental or idealistic clichés of one's elders. For a few weeks his references to the dear old place and to playing the game, to the white man's burden and a straight bat, had swept everyone, Ransom included, off their feet. But before he left Weddenshaw, Ransom had already begun to find Divine a bore, and at Cambridge he had avoided him, wondering from afar how anyone so flashy and, as it were, ready-made could be so successful. Then had come the mystery of Divine's election to the Leicester Fellowship, and the further mystery of his increasing wealth. He had long since abandoned Cambridge for London, and was presumably something in the city. One heard of him occasionally, and one's informant usually ended either by saying, "A damn clever chap, Divine," in his own way, or else by observing plaintively, "It's a mystery to me how that man has got where he is." As far as Ransom could gather from their brief conversation in the yard, his old schoolfellow had altered very little. He was interrupted by the opening of the door. Divine entered alone, carrying a bottle of whiskey on a tray with glasses and a siphon. "Weston is looking out something to eat," he said, as he placed the tray on the floor beside Ransom's chair and addressed himself to opening the bottle. Ransom, who was very thirsty indeed by now, observed that his host was one of those irritating people who forget to use their hands when they begin talking. Divine started to prise up the silver paper which covered the cork with the point of a corkscrew, and then stopped to ask, "How do you come to be in this benighted part of the country?" "I'm on a walking tour," said Ransom. "Slept at Stoke Underwood last night, and had hoped to end at Naderby tonight. They wouldn't put me up, so I was going on to Stirk." "God!" exclaimed Divine, his corkscrew still idle. "Do you do it for money, or is it sheer masochism?" "Pleasure, of course," said Ransom, keeping his eye immovably on the still unopened bottle. "Can the attraction of it be explained to the uninitiate?" asked Divine, remembering himself sufficiently to rip up a small portion of the silver paper. "I hardly know. To begin with, I like the actual walking." "God, you must have enjoyed the army, jogging along to Thingamy, eh?" "No, no, it's just the opposite of the army. The whole point about the army is that you are never alone for a moment, and can never choose where you're going, or even what part of the road you're walking on. On a walking tour you are absolutely detached. You stop where you like and go on when you like. As long as it lasts, you need consider no one, and consult no one but yourself. Until one night you find a wire waiting at your hotel, saying, 'Come back at once,'" replied Divine, at last removing the silver paper. "Only if you were fool enough to leave a list of addresses and go to them. The worst that could happen to me would be that man on the wireless saying, 'Will Dr. Elwin Ransom believe to be walking somewhere in the Midlands?'" "I begin to see the idea," said Divine, pausing in the very act of drawing the cork. "It wouldn't do if you were in business. You are a lucky devil. But can even you just disappear like that? No wife, no young, no aged but honest parent, or anything of that sort? Only a married sister in India. And then, you see, I'm a don, and a don in the middle of long vacation is almost a non-existent creature, as you ought to remember. College neither knows nor cares where he is, and certainly no one else does." The cork at last came out of the bottle with a heart-cheering noise. "Say when," said Divine, as Ransom held out his glass. "But I feel sure there's a catch somewhere. Do you really mean to say that no one knows where you are, or when you ought to get back, and no one can get hold of you?" Ransom was nodding in reply when Divine, who had picked up the siphon, suddenly swore. "I'm afraid this is empty," he said. "Do you mind having water? I'll have to get some from the scullery. How much do you like?" "Oh, fill it up, please," said Ransom. A few minutes later, Divine returned and handed Ransom his long-delayed drink. The latter remarked, as he put down the half-emptied tumbler with a sigh of satisfaction, that Divine's choice of residence was at least as odd as his own choice of a holiday. "Oh, quite," said Divine. "But if you knew Weston, you'd realize that it's much less trouble to go where he wants than to argue the matter. What you call a strong colleague." "Colleague?" asked Ransom inquiringly. "In a sense." Divine glanced at the door, drew his chair closer to Ransom's, and continued in a more confidential tone. "He's the goods all right, though. Between ourselves, I'm putting a little money into some experiments he has on hand. It's all straight stuff, the march of progress and the good of humanity and all that, but it has an industrial side." While Divine was speaking, something odd began to happen to Ransom. At first it merely seemed to him that Divine's words were no longer making sense. He appeared to be saying that he was industrial all down both sides, but could never get an experiment to fit him in London. Then he realized that Divine was not so much unintelligible as inaudible, which was not surprising, since he was now so far away, about a mile away, though perfectly clear, like something seen through the wrong end of a telescope. From that bright distance where he sat in his tiny chair, he was gazing at Ransom with a new expression on his face. The gaze became disconcerting. Ransom tried to move in his chair, but found that he had lost all power over his own body. He felt quite comfortable, but it was as if his legs and arms had been bandaged to the chair, and his head gripped in a vice, a beautifully padded but quite immovable vice. He did not feel afraid, though he knew that he ought to be afraid, and soon would be. Then, very gradually, the room faded from his sight. Ransom could never be sure whether what followed had any bearing on the events recorded in this book, or whether it was merely an irresponsible dream. It seemed to him that he and Weston and Divine were all standing in a little garden, surrounded by a wall. The garden was bright and sunlit, but over the top of the wall you could see nothing but darkness. They were trying to climb over the wall, and Weston asked them to give him a hoist up. Ransom kept on telling him not to go over the wall, because it was so dark on the other side. But Weston insisted, and all three of them set about doing so. Ransom was the last. He got astride on the top of the wall, sitting on his coat because of the broken bottles. The other two had already dropped down on the outside into the darkness. But before he followed them, a door in the wall, which none of them had noticed, was opened from without, and the queerest people he had ever seen came into the garden, bringing Weston and Divine back with them. They left them in the garden and retired into the darkness themselves, locking the door behind them. Ransom found it impossible to get down from the wall. He remained sitting there, not frightened, but rather uncomfortable, because his right leg, which was on the outside, felt so dark, and his left leg felt so light. "My leg will drop off if it gets much darker," he said. Then he looked down into the darkness and asked, "Who are you?" And the queer people must still have been there, for they all replied, "Who? Who? Who?" just like owls. He began to realize that his leg was not so much dark as cold and stiff, because he had been resting the other on it for so long, and also that he was in an armchair in a lighted room. A conversation was going on near him, and had, he now realized, been going on for some time. His head was comparatively clear. He realized that he had been drugged or hypnotized or both, and he felt that some control over his own body was returning to him, though he was still very weak. He listened intently, without trying to move. "I'm getting a little tired of this, Weston," Divine was saying, "and specially as it's my money that is being risked. I tell you, he'll do quite as well as the boy, and in some ways better. Only he'll be coming round very soon now, and we must get him on board at once. We ought to have done it an hour ago." "The boy was ideal," said Weston sulkily, "incapable of serving humanity, and only too likely to propagate idiocy. He was the sort of boy who in a civilized community would be automatically handed over to a state laboratory for experimental purposes." "Well, I dare say. But in England he is the sort of boy in whom Scotland Yard might conceivably feel an interest. This busybody, on the other hand, will not be missed for months, and even then no one will know where he was when he disappeared. He came alone, he left no address, he has no family, and finally he has poked his nose into the whole affair of his own accord." "Well, I confess I don't like it. He is, after all, human. The boy was really almost a preparation. Still, he's only an individual, and probably a quite useless one. We're risking our own lives, too, in a great cause. Oh, for the Lord's sake, don't start all that stuff now. We haven't time." "I dare say," replied Weston, "he would consent if he could be made to understand." "Take his feet, and I'll take his head," said Divine. "If you really think he's coming round," said Weston, "you'd better give him another dose. We can't start till we get the sunlight. It wouldn't be pleasant to have him struggling in there for 3 hours or so. It would be better if he didn't wake up till we were under way." "True enough. Just keep an eye on him while I run upstairs and get another." Divine left the room. Ransom saw through his half-closed eyes that Weston was standing over him. He had no means of foretelling how his own body would respond, if it responded at all, to a sudden attempt of movement, but he saw at once that he must take his chance. Almost before Divine had closed the door, he flung himself with all his force at Weston's feet. The scientist fell forward across the chair, and Ransom, flinging him off with an agonizing effort, rose and dashed out into the hall. He was very weak, and fell as he entered it. But terror was behind him, and in a couple of seconds he had found the hall door and was working desperately to master the bolts. Darkness and his trembling hands were against him. Before he had drawn one bolt, booted feet were clattering over the carpetless floor behind him. He was gripped by the shoulders and the knees, kicking, writhing, dripping with sweat, and bellowing as loud as he could in the faint hope of rescue. He prolonged the struggle with a violence of which he would have believed himself incapable. For one glorious moment the door was open. The fresh night air was in his face. He saw the reassuring stars, and even his own pack lying in the porch. Then a heavy blow fell on his head. Consciousness faded, and the last thing of which he was aware was the grip of strong hands pulling him back into the dark passage, and the sound of a closing door. Chapter 3. When Ransom came to his senses, he seemed to be in bed in a dark room. He had a pretty severe headache, and this, combined with a general lassitude, discouraged him at first from attempting to rise or to take stock of his surroundings. He noticed, drawing his hand across his forehead, that he was sweating freely, and this directed his attention to the fact that the room, if it was a room, was remarkably warm. Moving his arms to fling off the bedclothes, he touched a wall at the right side of the bed. It was not only warm, but hot. He moved his hand to and fro in the emptiness on the other side, and noticed that there the air was cooler. Apparently the heat was coming from the wall. He felt his face and found a bruise over the left eye. This recalled to his mind the struggle with Weston and Devine, and he instantly concluded that they had put him in an outhouse behind their furnace. At the same time he looked up and recognized the source of the dim light in which, without noticing it, he had all along been able to see the movements of his own hands. There was some kind of skylight immediately over his head, a square of night sky filled with stars. It seemed to Ransom that he had never looked out on such a frosty night. Pulsing with brightness as with some unbearable pain or pleasure, clustered in pathless and countless multitudes, dreamlike in clarity, blazing in perfect blackness, the stars seized all his attention, troubled him, excited him, and drew him up to a sitting position. At the same time they quickened the throb of his headache, and this reminded him that he had been drugged. He was just formulating to himself the theory that the stuff they had given him might have some effect on the pupil, and that this would explain the unnatural splendour and fullness of the sky, when a disturbance of silver light, almost a pale and miniature sunrise at one corner of the skylight, drew his eyes upward again. Some minutes later, the orb of the full moon was pushing its way into the field of vision. Ransom sat still and watched. He had never seen such a moon, so white, so blinding and so large. Like a great football just outside the glass, he thought. And then, a moment later, no, it's bigger than that. By this time he was quite certain that something was seriously wrong with his eyes. No moon could possibly be the size of the thing he was seeing. The light of the huge moon, if it was a moon, had by now illuminated his surroundings almost as clearly as if it were day. It was a very strange room. The floor was so small that the bed and a table beside it occupied the whole width of it. The ceiling seemed to be nearly twice as wide, and the walls sloped outwards as they rose, so that Ransom had the impression of lying at the bottom of a deep and narrow wheelbarrow. This confirmed his belief that his sight was either temporarily or permanently injured. In other respects, however, he was recovering rapidly, and even beginning to feel an unnatural lightness of heart and a not disagreeable excitement. The heat was still oppressive, and he stripped off everything but his shirt and trousers before rising to explore. His rising was disastrous and raised graver apprehensions in his mind about the effects of being drugged. Although he had been conscious of no unusual muscular effort, he found himself leaping from the bed with an energy which brought his head into sharp contact with the skylight and flung him down again in a heap on the floor. He found himself on the other side against the wall. The wall that ought to have sloped outwards, like the side of a wheelbarrow, according to his previous reconnaissance. But it didn't. He felt it and looked at it. It was unmistakably at right angles to the floor. More cautiously this time, he rose again to his feet. He felt an extraordinary lightness of body. It was with difficulty that he kept his feet on the floor. For the first time, a suspicion that he might be dead and already in the ghost life crossed his mind. He was trembling. But 100 mental habits forbade him to consider this possibility. Instead, he explored his prison. The result was beyond doubt. All the walls looked as if they sloped outwards, so as to make the room wider at the ceiling than it was at the floor. But each wall, as you stood beside it, turned out to be perfectly perpendicular, not only to sight, but to touch also, if one stooped down and examined with one's fingers the angle between it and the floor. The same examination revealed two other curious facts. The room was walled and floored with metal, and was in a state of continuous faint vibration, a silent vibration with a strangely lifelike and unmechanical quality about it. But if the vibration was silent, there was plenty of noise going on, a series of musical raps or percussions at quite irregular intervals, which seemed to come from the ceiling. It was as if the metal chamber in which he found himself was being bombarded with small, tinkling missiles. Ransom was by now thoroughly frightened, not with the prosaic fright that a man suffers in a war, but with a heady, bounding kind of fear that was hardly distinguishable from his general excitement. He was poised on a sort of emotional watershed from which, he felt, he might at any moment pass into delirious terror or into an ecstasy of joy. He knew now that he was not in a house, but in some moving vessel. It was clearly not a submarine, and the infinitesimal quivering of the metal did not suggest the motion of any wheeled vehicle. A ship, then, he supposed, or some kind of airship. But there was an oddity in all his sensations for which neither supposition accounted. Puzzled, he sat down again on the bed and stared at the portentous moon. An airship, some kind of flying machine. But why did the moon look so big? It was larger than he had thought at first. No moon could really be that size. And he realized now that he had known this from the first, but had repressed the knowledge through terror. At the same moment, a thought came into his head which stopped his breath. There could be no full moon at all that night. He remembered distinctly that he had walked from Naderby in a moonless night. Even if the thin crescent of a new moon had escaped his notice, it could not have grown to this in a few hours. It could not have grown to this at all, this megalomaniac disk, far larger than the football he had at first compared it to, larger than a child's hoop, filling almost half the sky. And where was the old man in the moon, the familiar face that had looked down on all the generations of men? The thing wasn't the moon at all, and he felt his hair move on his scalp. At that moment the sound of an opening door made him turn his head. An oblong of dazzling light appeared behind him and instantly vanished as the door closed again, having admitted the bulky form of a naked man whom Ransom recognized as Weston. No reproach, no demand for an explanation rose to Ransom's lips or even to his mind, not with that monstrous orb above them. The mere presence of a human being, with its offer of at least some companionship, broke down the tension in which his nerves had long been resisting a bottomless dismay. He found when he spoke that he was sobbing. "Weston, Weston," he gasped, "what is it? It's not the moon, not that size. It can't be, can it?" "No," replied Weston. "It's the earth." Chapter 4 Ransom's legs failed him, and he must have sunk back upon the bed, but he only became aware of this many minutes later. At the moment he was unconscious of everything except his fear. He did not even know what he was afraid of. The fear itself possessed his whole mind, a formless, infinite misgiving. He did not lose consciousness, though he greatly wished that he might do so. Any change, death or sleep, or best of all, a waking which would show all this for a dream, would have been inexpressibly welcome. None came. Instead, the lifelong self-control of social man, the virtues which are half hypocrisy, or the hypocrisy which is half a virtue, came back to him, and soon he found himself answering Weston in a voice not shamefully tremulous. "Do you mean that?" he asked. "Certainly." "Then where are we?"
"Standing out from Earth about 85,000 miles.
"You mean we're in space?"
Ransom uttered the word with difficulty, as a frightened child speaks of ghosts or a frightened man of cancer. Weston nodded.
"What for?" said Ransom. "And what on earth have you kidnapped me for? And how have you done it?"
For a moment Weston seemed disposed to give no answer. Then, as if on a second thought, he sat down on the bed beside Ransom and spoke as follows.
"I suppose it will save trouble if I deal with these questions at once, instead of leaving you to pester us with them every hour for the next month. As to how we do it, I suppose you mean how the spaceship works. There's no good your asking that. Unless you were one of the 4 or 5 real physicists now living, you couldn't understand. And if there were any chance of your understanding, you certainly wouldn't be told. If it makes you happy to repeat words that don't mean anything, which is in fact what unscientific people want when they ask for an explanation, you may say we work by exploiting the less observed properties of solar radiation. As to why we are here, we are on our way to Malacandra."
"Do you mean a star called Malacandra?"
Even you can hardly suppose we are going out of the solar system. Malacandra is much nearer than that. We shall make it in about 28 days.
Well, there isn't a planet called Malacandra, objected Ransom.
I am giving it its real name, not the name invented by terrestrial astronomers, said Weston.
Oh, but surely this is nonsense, said Ransom.
How the deuce did you find out its real name, as you call it?
From the inhabitants.
It took Ransom some time to digest this statement.
Do you mean to tell me you claim to have been to this star before, or this planet, or whatever it is?
Yes.
You can't really ask me to believe that, said Ransom. Damn it all, it's not an everyday affair. Why has no one heard of it? Why has it not been in all the papers?
Because we are not perfect idiots, said Weston gruffly.
After a few moments' silence, Ransom began again.
Which planet is it in our terminology? He asked.
Once and for all, said Weston, I am not going to tell you. If you know how to find out when we get there, you are welcome to do so. I don't think we have much to fear from your scientific attainments. In the meantime, there is no reason for you to know.
And you say this place is inhabited, said Ransom. Weston gave him a peculiar look and then nodded.
The uneasiness which this produced in Ransom rapidly merged in an anger which he had almost lost sight of amidst the conflicting emotions that beset him.
And what has all this to do with me? He broke out.
You have assaulted me, drugged me, and are apparently carrying me off as a prisoner in this infernal thing. What have I done to you? What do you say for yourself?
I might reply by asking you why you crept into my backyard like a thief. If you had minded your own business, you would not be here. As it is, I admit that we have had to infringe your rights. My only defense is that small claims must give way to great. As far as we know, we are doing what has never been done in the history of man, perhaps never in the history of the universe. We have learned how to jump off the speck of matter on which our species began. Infinity, and therefore perhaps eternity, is being put into the hands of the human race. You cannot be so small-minded as to think that the rights or the life of an individual, or of a million individuals, are of the slightest importance in comparison with this.
I happen to disagree, said Ransom, and I always have disagreed, even about vivisection. But you haven't answered my question. What do you want me for? What good am I to do you on this, on Malacandra?
That I don't know, said Weston. It was no idea of ours. We're only obeying orders.
Whose?
There was another pause.
Come, said Weston at last. There is really no use in continuing this cross-examination. You keep on asking me questions I can't answer. In some cases, because I don't know the answers, in others, because you wouldn't understand them. It will make things very much pleasanter during the voyage if you can only resign your mind to your fate and stop bothering yourself and us. It would be easier if your philosophy of life were not so insufferably narrow and individualistic. I had thought no one could fail to be inspired by the role you are being asked to play, that even a worm, if it could understand, would rise to the sacrifice. I mean, of course, the sacrifice of time and liberty and some little risk. Don't misunderstand me.
Well, said Ransom, you hold all the cards, and I must make the best of it. I consider your philosophy of life raving lunacy. I suppose all that stuff about affinity and eternity means you think you are justified in doing anything, absolutely anything, here and now, on the off chance that some creatures or other descended from man, as we know him, may crawl about a few centuries longer in some part of the universe.
Yes, anything whatever, returned the scientist sternly, and all educated opinion, for I do not call classics and history and such trash education, is entirely on my side.
I'm glad you raised the point, and I advise you to remember my answer. In the meantime, if you will follow me into the next room, we will have breakfast. Be careful how you get up. Your weight here is hardly appreciable compared with your weight on Earth.
Ransom rose, and his captor opened the door. Instantly the room was flooded with a dazzling golden light, which completely eclipsed the pale Earthlight behind him.
"I will give you darkened glasses in a moment," said Weston, as he preceded him into the chamber whence the radiance was pouring. It seemed to Ransom that Weston went up a hill towards the doorway and disappeared suddenly downwards when he had passed it. When he followed, which he did with caution, he had the curious impression that he was walking up to the edge of a precipice. The new room beyond the doorway seemed to be built on its side, so that its farther wall lay almost in the same plane as the floor of the room he was leaving. When, however, he ventured to put forward his foot, he found that the floor continued flush,
and as he entered the second room, the walls suddenly righted themselves, and the rounded ceiling was over his head. Looking back, he perceived that the bedroom, in its turn, was now heeling over, its roof a wall, and one of its walls a roof. "You'll soon get used to it," said Weston, following his gaze. "The ship is roughly spherical, and now we are outside the gravitational field of the Earth, down means and fields towards the centre of our own little metal world. This, of course, was foreseen, and we built her accordingly. The core of the ship is a hollow globe. We keep our stores inside it, and the surface of that globe is the floor we are walking on. The cabins are arranged all around this, their walls supporting an outer globe, which, from our point of view, is the roof. As the centre is always down, the piece of floor you are standing on always feels flat or horizontal, and the wall you are standing against always seems vertical. On the other hand, the globe of floor is so small that you can always see over the edge of it, over what would be the horizon if you were a flea, and then you see the floors and wall of the next cabin in a different plane. It is just the same on Earth, of course, only we are not big enough to see it." After this explanation, he made arrangements in his precise, ungracious way for the comfort of his guest, or prisoner. Ransom, at his advice, removed all his clothes and substituted a little metal girdle hung with enormous weights to reduce, as far as possible, the unmanageable lightness of his body. He also assumed tinted glasses, and soon found himself seated opposite Weston at a small table laid for breakfast. He was both hungry and thirsty, and eagerly attacked the meal, which consisted of tinned meat, biscuit, butter, and coffee. But all these actions he had performed mechanically, stripping, eating, and drinking passed almost unnoticed, and all he ever remembered of his first meal in the spaceship was the tyranny of heat and light. Both were present in a degree which would have been intolerable on Earth, but each had a new quality. The light was paler than any light of comparable intensity that he had ever seen. It was not pure white, but the palest of all imaginable golds, and it cast shadows as sharp as a floodlight. The heat, utterly free from moisture, seemed to knead and stroke the skin like a gigantic masseur. It produced no tendency to drowsiness, rather intense alacrity. His headache was gone. He felt vigilant, courageous, and magnanimous, as he had seldom felt on Earth. Gradually he dared to raise his eyes to the skylight. Steel shutters were drawn across all but a chink of the glass, and that chink was covered with blinds of some heavy and dark material. But still it was too bright to look at. "I always thought space was dark and cold," he remarked vaguely. "Forgotten the sun?" said Weston contemptuously. Ransom went on eating for some time. Then he began, "If it's like this in the early morning," and stopped, warned by the expression on Weston's face. Awe fell upon him. There were no mornings here, no evenings, and no night, nothing but the changeless noon which had filled for centuries beyond history so many millions of cubic miles. He glanced at Weston again, but the latter held up his hand. "Don't talk," he said. "We have discussed all that is necessary. The ship does not carry oxygen enough for any unnecessary exertion, not even for talking." Shortly afterwards he rose, without inviting the other to follow him, and left the room by one of the many doors which Ransom had not yet seen opened. Chapter 5. The period spent in the spaceship ought to have been one of terror and anxiety for Ransom. He was separated by an astronomical distance from every member of the human race, except two, whom he had excellent reasons for distrusting. He was heading for an unknown destination, and was being brought thither for a purpose which his captors steadily refused to disclose. Devine and Weston relieved each other regularly in a room which Ransom was never allowed to enter, and where he supposed the controls of their machine must be. Weston, during his watches off, was almost entirely silent. Devine was more loquacious, and would often talk and guffaw with the prisoner, until Weston rapped on the wall of the control room and warned them not to waste air. But Devine was secretive after a certain point. He was quite ready to laugh at Weston's solemn scientific idealism. He didn't give a damn, he said, for the future of the species or the meeting of two worlds. "There's more to Malacandra than that," he would add with a wink. But when Ransom asked him what more, he would lapse into satire and make ironical remarks about the white man's burden and the blessings of civilization. "It is inhabited, then?" Ransom would press. "Ah, there's always a native question in these things," Devine would answer.
For the most part, his conversation ran on the things he would do when he got back to Earth. Ocean-going yachts, the most expensive women, and a big place on the Riviera figured largely in his plans. I'm not running all these risks for fun.
Direct questions about Ransom's own role were usually met with silence. Only once, in reply to such a question, Divine, who was then, in Ransom's opinion, very far from sober, admitted that they were rather handing him the baby.
But I'm sure, he added, you'll live up to the old school tie.
All this, as I have said, was sufficiently disquieting. The odd thing was that it did not very greatly disquiet him. It is hard for a man to brood on the future when he is feeling so extremely well, as Ransom now felt. There was an endless night on one side of the ship, and an endless day on the other. Each was marvellous, and he moved from the one to the other at his will, delighted. In the nights, which he could create by turning the handle of a door, he lay for hours in contemplation of the skylight. The Earth's disk was nowhere to be seen. The stars, thick as daisies on an uncut lawn, reigned perpetually, with no cloud, no moon, no sunrise to dispute their sway. There were planets of unbelievable majesty, and constellations undreamed of. There were celestial sapphires, rubies, emeralds, and pinpricks of burning gold. Far out on the left of the picture hung a comet, tiny and remote. And between all and behind all, far more emphatic and palpable than it showed on Earth, the undimensioned, enigmatic blackness. The lights trembled. They seemed to grow brighter as he looked. Stretched naked on his bed, a second Danae, he found it night by night more difficult to disbelieve in old astrology. Almost he felt, wholly he imagined, sweet influence pouring or even stabbing into his surrendered body. All was silence but for the irregular tinkling noises. He knew now that these were made by meteorites, small, drifting particles of the world stuff that smote continually on their hollow drum of steel. And he guessed that at any moment they might meet something large enough to make meteorites of ship and all. But he could not fear. He now felt that Weston had justly called him little-minded in the moment of his first panic. The adventure was too high, its circumstance too solemn, for any emotion save a severe delight. But the days, that is, the hours spent in the sunward hemisphere of their microcosm, were the best of all. Often he rose after only a few hours' sleep to return, drawn by an irresistible attraction to the region of light. He could not cease to wonder at the noon which always awaited you, however early you went to seek it. There, totally immersed in a bath of pure ethereal colour and of unrelenting though unwounding brightness, stretched his full length and with eyes half closed in the strange chariot that bore them, faintly quivering through depth after depth of tranquillity far above the reach of night, he felt his body and mind daily rubbed and scoured and filled with new vitality. Weston, in one of his brief, reluctant answers, admitted a scientific basis for these sensations. They were receiving, he said, many rays that never penetrated the terrestrial atmosphere. But Ransom, as time wore on, became aware of another and more spiritual cause for his progressive lightening and exaltation of heart. A nightmare, long engendered in the modern mind by the mythology that follows in the wake of science, was falling off him. He had read of space. At the back of his thinking for years had lurked the dismal fancy of the black, cold vacuity, the utter deadness which was supposed to separate the worlds. He had not known how much it affected him till now. Now that the very name, space, seemed a blasphemous libel for this empyrean ocean of radiance in which they swam. He could not call it dead. He felt life pouring into him from it every moment. How indeed should it be otherwise, since out of this ocean the worlds and all their life had come? He had thought it barren. He saw now that it was the womb of worlds, whose blazing and innumerable offspring looked down nightly even upon the earth with so many eyes. And here, with how many more? No, space was the wrong name. Older thinkers had been wiser when they named it simply the heavens. The heavens which declared the glory, the happy climes that lie where day never shuts his eye, up in the broad fields of the sky. He quoted Milton's words to himself lovingly, at this time and often. He did not, of course, spend all his time in basking. He explored the ship, so far as he was allowed, passing from room to room with those slow movements which Weston enjoined upon them, lest exertion should overtax their supply of air. From the necessity of its shape, the spaceship contained a good many more chambers than were in regular use, but Ransom was also inclined to think that its owners, or at least Divine, intended these to be filled with cargo of some kind on the return journey. The steward and cook of the company, partly because he felt it natural to share the only labours he could share, he was never allowed in the control room, and partly in order to anticipate a tendency which Weston showed to make him a servant, whether he would or no. He preferred to work as a volunteer rather than in admitted slavery, and he liked his own cooking a good deal more than that of his companions. It was these duties that made him at first the unwilling and then the alarmed hearer of a conversation which occurred about a fortnight, he judged, after the beginning of their voyage. He had washed up the remains of their evening meal, basked in the sunlight, chatted with Divine, better company than Weston, though in Ransom's opinion much the more odious of the two, and retired to bed at his usual time. He was a little restless, and after an hour or so it occurred to him that he had forgotten one or two small arrangements in the galley which would facilitate his work in the morning. The galley opened off the saloon, or day-room, and its door was close to that of the control-room. He rose and went there at once. His feet, like the rest of him, were bare. The galley skylight was on the dark side of the ship, but Ransom did not turn on the light. To leave the door ajar was sufficient, as this admitted a stream of brilliant sunlight. As everyone who has kept house will understand, he found that his preparations for the morning had been even more incomplete than he supposed. He did his work well, from practice, and therefore quietly. He had just finished and was drying his hands on the roller towel behind the galley door when he heard the door of the control room open and saw the silhouette of a man outside the galley. Divine's, he gathered. Divine did not come forward into the saloon, but remained standing and talking, apparently into the control room. It thus came about that while Ransom could hear distinctly what Divine said, he could not make out Weston's answers. "I think it would be damn silly," said Divine. "If you could be sure of meeting the brutes where we alight, there might be something in it. But suppose we have to trek. All we'd gain by your plan would be having to carry a drugged man and his pack instead of letting a live man walk with us and do his share of the work." Weston apparently replied. "But he can't find out," returned Divine. "Even if he suspects, do you think a man like that would have the guts to run away on a strange planet, without food, without weapons? You'll find he'll eat out of your hand at the first sight of a Sorn." Again Ransom heard the indistinct noise of Weston's voice. "How should I know?" said Divine. "It may be some sort of chief, much more likely a mumbo-jumbo." This time came a very short utterance from the control room. Apparently a question. Divine answered at once. It would explain why he was wanted. Weston asked him something more. Human sacrifice, I suppose. Well, at least he wouldn't be human from their point of view. You know what I mean. Weston had a good deal to say this time, and it elicited Divine's characteristic chuckle. Quite, quite, he said. It is understood that you are doing it all from the highest motives. So long as they lead to the same actions as my motives, you are quite welcome to them. Weston continued, and this time Divine seemed to interrupt him. "You're not losing your own nerve, are you?" he said. He was then silent for some time, as if listening. Finally he replied, "If you're so fond of the brutes as that, you'd better stay and interbreed. If they have sexes, which we don't yet know. Oh, don't you worry. When the time comes for cleaning the place up, we'll save one or two for you, and you can keep them as pets, or vivisect them, or sleep with them, or all three, whichever way it takes you." "Yes, I know. Perfectly loathsome. I was only joking. Good night." A moment later Divine closed the door of the control room, crossed the saloon, and entered his own cabin. Ransom heard him bolt the door of it, according to his invariable, though puzzling, custom. The tension with which he had been listening relaxed. He found that he had been holding his breath and breathed deeply again. Then cautiously he stepped out into the saloon. Though he knew that it would be prudent to return to his bed as quickly as possible, he found himself standing still in the now familiar glory of the light, and viewing it with a new and poignant emotion. Out of this heaven, these happy climes, they were presently to descend into what? Sorns, human sacrifice, loathsome sexless monsters. What was a Sorn? His own role in the affair was now clear enough. Somebody or something had sent for him. It could hardly be for him personally, that somebody wanted a victim, any victim, from Earth. He had been picked because Divine had done the picking. He realized for the first time, in all circumstances a late and startling discovery, that Divine had hated him all these years as heartily as he hated Divine. But what was a sorn? When he saw them, he would eat out of Divine's hands. His mind, like so many minds of his generation, was richly furnished with bogies. He had read his H. G. Wells and others. His universe was peopled with horrors such as ancient and medieval mythology could hardly rival. No insect-like vermiculate or crustacean abominable, no twitching feelers, rasping wings, slimy coils, curling tentacles, no monstrous union of superhuman intelligence and insatiable cruelty seemed to him anything but likely on an alien world. The Sorns would be... He dared not think what the Sorns would be, and he was to be given to them. Somehow this seemed more horrible than being caught by them. Given, handed over, offered. He saw in imagination various incompatible monstrosities. Bulbous eyes, grinning jaws, horns, stings, mandibles. Loathing of insects, loathing of snakes, loathing of things that squashed and squelched, all played their horrible symphonies over his nerves. But the reality would be worse. It would be an extraterrestrial otherness, something one had never thought of, never could have thought of. In that moment Ransom made a decision. He could face death, but not the Sorns. He must escape when they got to Malacandra, if there were any possibility. Starvation, or even to be chased by Sorns, would be better than being handed over. If escape were impossible, then it must be suicide. Ransom was a pious man. He hoped he would be forgiven. It was no more in his power, he thought, to decide otherwise than to grow a new limb. Without hesitation, he stole back into the galley and secured the sharpest knife. Henceforward, he determined never to be parted from it. Such was the exhaustion produced by terror that when he regained his bed, he fell instantly into stupefied and dreamless sleep. Chapter 6. He woke much refreshed, and even a little ashamed of his terror on the previous night. His situation was, no doubt, very serious. Indeed, the possibility of returning alive to Earth must be almost discounted. But death could be faced, and rational fear of death could be mastered. It was only the irrational, the biological horror of monsters that was the real difficulty. And this he faced and came to terms with as well as he could while he lay in the sunlight after breakfast. He had the feeling that one sailing in the heavens, as he was doing, should not suffer abject dismay before any earthbound creature. He even reflected that the knife could pierce other flesh as well as his own. The bellicose mood was a very rare one with Ransom. Like many men of his own age, he rather underestimated than overestimated his own courage. The gap between boyhood's dreams and his actual experience of the war had been startling, and his subsequent view of his own unheroic qualities had perhaps swung too far in the opposite direction. He had some anxiety lest the firmness of his present mood should prove a short-lived illusion, but he must make the best of it. As hour followed hour and waking followed sleep in their eternal day, he became aware of a gradual change. The temperature was slowly falling. They resumed clothes. Later they added warm underclothes. Later still an electric heater was turned on in the center of the ship. And it became certain, too, though the phenomenon was hard to seize, that the light was less overwhelming than it had been at the beginning of the voyage. It became certain to the comparing intellect, but it was difficult to feel what was happening as a diminution of light, and impossible to think of it as darkening, because, while the radiance changed in degree, its unearthly quality had remained exactly the same since the moment he first beheld it. It was not like fading light upon the earth mixed with the increasing moisture and phantom colours of the air. You might halve its intensity, Ransom perceived, and the remaining half would still be what the whole had been, merely less, not other. Halve it again, and the residue would still be the same. As long as it was at all, it would be itself. Out even to that unimagined distance where its last force was spent. He tried to explain what he meant to Divine.
"Like Thingamy's soap," grinned Divine. "Pure soap to the last bubble, eh?"
Shortly after this, the even tenor of their life in the spaceship began to be disturbed. Weston explained that they would soon begin to feel the gravitational pull of Malacandra.
"That means," he said, "that it will no longer be down to the center of the ship.
It will be down towards Malacandra, which from our point of view will be under the control room. As a consequence, the floors of most of the chambers will become wall or roof, and one of the walls a floor. You won't like it. The result of this announcement, so far as Ransom was concerned, was hours of heavy labour, in which he worked shoulder to shoulder, now with Divine and now with Weston, as their alternating watches liberated them from the control room. Water tins, oxygen cylinders, guns, ammunition and foodstuffs had all to be piled on the floors alongside the appropriate walls, and lying on their sides so as to be upright when the new downwards came into play. Long before the work was finished, disturbing sensations began. At first Ransom supposed that it was the toil itself which so weighted his limbs, but rest did not alleviate the symptom, and it was explained to him that their bodies, in response to the planet that had caught them in its field, were actually gaining weight every minute, and doubling in weight with every 24 hours. They had the experiences of a pregnant woman, but magnified almost beyond endurance. At the same time their sense of direction, never very confident on the spaceship, became continuously confused. From any room on board, the next room's floor had always looked downhill and felt level. Now it looked downhill and felt a little, a very little downhill as well. One found oneself running as one entered it. A cushion flung aside on the floor of the saloon would be found hours later to have moved an inch or so towards the wall. All of them were afflicted with vomiting, headache and palpitations of the heart. The conditions grew worse hour by hour. Soon one could only grope and crawl from cabin to cabin. All sense of direction disappeared in a sickening confusion. Parts of the ship were definitely below, in the sense that their floors were upside down, and only a fly could walk on them. But no part seemed to Ransom to be indisputably the right way up. Sensations of intolerable height and of falling, utterly absent in the heavens, recurred constantly. Cooking, of course, had long since been abandoned. Food was snatched as best they could, and drinking presented great difficulties. You could never be sure that you were really holding your mouth below rather than beside the bottle. Weston grew grimmer and more silent than ever. Divine, a flask of spirits ever in his hand, flung out strange blasphemies and coprologies, and cursed Weston for bringing them. Ransom ached, licked his dry lips, nursed his bruised limbs, and prayed for the end. A time came when one side of the sphere was unmistakably down. Clamped beds and tables hung useless and ridiculous on what was now wall or roof. What had been doors became trapdoors, opened with difficulty. Their bodies seemed made of lead. There was no more work to be done when Divine had set out the clothes, their Malacandrian clothes, from their bundles, and squatted down on the end of the saloon, now its floor, to watch the thermometer. The clothes, Ransom noticed, included heavy woolen underwear, sheepskin jerkins, fur gloves, and eared caps. Divine made no reply to his questions. He was engaged in studying the thermometer and in shouting down to Weston in the control room. "Slower! Slower!" he kept shouting. "Slower, you damned fool! You'll be in air in a minute or two." Then sharply and angrily, "Here, let me get at it!" Weston made no replies. It was unlike Divine to waste his advice. Ransom concluded that the man was almost out of his senses, whether with fear or excitement. Suddenly the lights of the universe seemed to be turned down. As if some demon had rubbed the heaven's face with a dirty sponge, the splendour in which they had lived for so long blenched to a pallid, cheerless and pitiable grey. It was impossible from where they sat to open the shutters or roll back the heavy blind. What had been a chariot gliding in the fields of heaven became a dark steel box dimly lighted by a slit of window, and falling. They were falling out of the heaven into a world. Nothing in all his adventures bit so deeply into Ransom's mind as this. He wondered how he could ever have thought of planets, even of the Earth, as islands of life and reality floating in a deadly void. Now, with a certainty which never after deserted him, he saw the planets, the Earths, he called them in his thought, as mere holes or gaps in the living heaven, excluded and rejected wastes of heavy matter and murky air, formed not by addition to, but by subtraction from, the surrounding brightness. And yet, he thought, beyond the solar system the brightness ends. Is that the real void, the real death? Unless, he groped for the idea, unless visible light is also a hole or gap, a mere diminution of something else, something that is to bright, unchanging heaven as heaven is to the dark, heavy earths. Things do not always happen as a man would expect. The moment of his arrival in an unknown world found Ransom wholly absorbed in a philosophical speculation.